This is Purple Radio on demand.
Hello and welcome to Who's Up Podcasts. Today we're going to be discussing The Giggle. First of all, spoiler warning for The Giggle, as well as The Star Beast, A Wild Blue Yonder, and all of Doctor Who that's come before. We'll do our best. There's been like things released about the Christmas special. I know some people are not wanting to watch the song that was released. So I think we're going to do our best not to spoil anything that happened in that. Other than that, we will be discussing trailer footage and stuff in the Christmas special, but mostly we're discussing The Giggle, so spoiler warning for that. I'm here with Louis.
Hello.
Harry.
Hello.
And Bertie.
Hiya.
So, what did we all think of the final of the three specials, The Giggle?
I really enjoyed it. It felt a little fan servicey, but I am a fan. I was happy to be serviced. It had the most beautiful ending for me. Just seeing David Tennant's Doctor happy for once was really nice.
Yeah, I think, if I'm entirely honest, coming out of it, I was a bit disappointed, and I will be talking about why, but the more I've thought about it, the more positively I look back on it. But there are definitely issues I have that I want to talk through, but there were also many things that I thought were absolutely wonderful. So, yeah. Louis, Harry, what's your overall vibe?
I enjoyed it, yeah. I had seen a leak of what was going to happen at the end. And
the bi-generation.
Yeah. And seeing it in the episode, I was a lot happier about it than I was before.
That's
fair.
I
think it worked better than I was expecting it to.
That's good.
I think I agree with Ollie over it, but I think Moraine a lot more positive over what he was trying to do rather than, of course, how it actually turned out, but hey-ho.
Yeah, that's fair. So, the episode opens exactly as Wild Blue Yonder closed. We have they're on the streets of Camden. Everyone thinks they're right, and it's causing chaos. And we immediately see some guy going, "Everyone thinks they're right. They've all gone mad, but not me. I've always been right." You know, I think it's a very interesting political sort of thing. It's sort of as a comment on the discourse, like political discourse generally in the world, of everyone does just think they're right all the time. It was a very, in my opinion, how do I put this? Just sort of telling rather than showing, I thought. Right, rather than showing people thinking they're right, we just had a guy going, "Everyone thinks they're right, and I'm right." You know, it was very much a bit of an exposition dump, in my opinion. And I thought, I think it's such a good concept, and I think there's so much you can do with it, but I don't think they did much with it, because we saw it at the start, and we'll get onto a bit about Kate's tirade, which works really well in my opinion, but we don't really see the consequences of it. And like, as soon as they go into UNIT, we don't even see anyone actually doing that besides some people on TV. Which, why are the TV networks even up? If for 2 days we've had this level of chaos, surely everyone working in TV, I don't know. I feel like the world should be in more chaos than it is.
I think you could say that about every story that does that. That does that sort of thing.
YouTubers. Like, maybe it was their own little YouTube network that they had
the
up.
Internet. And they had... But you need people to maintain the internet, don't you? And also it wasn't. It was literally the news.
Maybe there were YouTubers with a news format.
Well, maybe people were thinking, "I'm right to keep the services up.
You need lots of people to cooperate to do that, and clearly no one. What? Why was UNIT even up? Like, I know they had the little wristbands, but how did Mel and that little funny robot thing, the Vlinx, just like collaborate to make these little bracelets? I don't know. I feel like that was brushed over way too easily, personally.
It didn't have a direct answer to your questions, but it's fun to speculate. Maybe everyone at UNIT thought they were right to protect the planet. Maybe they're like, "I'm so right for my job."
Yeah,
maybe
but I feel like they
like
wouldn't.
Little capitalist baddies, you know.
But we did see what happened to Kate as soon as she took hers off. So...
Yes. Yeah. And and which, to be honest, was a very incredibly written and acted tirade. Mm-hmm. It really felt very real to what a lot of bigoted people are actually like, if exaggerated. And there was one particular thing she referred to, which was, I'd say, a case of really good representation of something that probably a lot of people didn't even think of was a thing.
It was a really, really good tirade, because she was sort of having a go at, oh, what's her name? Her
Shirley.
Name's just completely... Shirley. Why did I forget her name? Kate was having a go at Shirley, but it was paired with really other stupid, stupid things like gingered-haired people and the doctor being like, oh, don't trust the doctor. He's an alien. But it was really nice them pairing ambulatory wheelchair users in the same bracket of, if you think that's stupid, you also must think that ginger haired people are conspiring against us all, because it's all clearly cap.
Yeah.
So I think it was done really nicely, and it really like felt part of the scene, and it didn't feel like signposty or like they were doing it like to be like, look, we're inclusive. It felt very real to the scene. But I feel like this series, these specials in particular, are really good at that.
Yeah, so much. Different varieties of representation.
Yeah.
We obviously had the amazing trans representation in the Star Beast, and we've now got... I mean, we had very good disabled representation in the Star Beast, and we've got it again here with showing her as an ambulatory wheelchair user, and then similarly... you get at the end the TARDIS becoming wheelchair accessible, which is great. It's really nice to see these things. So obviously, in amongst all the panic, we get UNIT find the Doctor, Donna and Wilf, and Wilf is, unfortunately, because he really sadly passed away, wasn't able to film any scenes for this episode. They sort of had to write him out, and I think they did it as best they could. That you can tell that his one line, you go with the Doctor, is it's footage from the series 4 episode that they've reused for this scene. And I think they, you know, making it clear that he is actually there by having an audio line from him, I think it was a good idea, and it was the best they could do.
I think as well, it sort of reminded me of what they tried to do with Carrie Fisher, but I think here it was done in a better way by just saying, okay, he's just in the background. Unfortunately, this is the best we're going to do. And I think, particularly at the end, where you see that he is sort of implied to be still alive, he was quite happy to see that, yes, and the Doctor will join with them after.
I do like to say, I would like to say that I don't think he would be shooting moles.
Apparently that was based on something Bernard Cribbins actually did.
No.
I heard that somewhere.
Shoot a mole? Moles are kind of cute.
Well, to be fair, at least the moles were fine because they had a force field.
Yeah, I like to believe that my wolf would never shoot a mole or any animal. Canon is what I make it, and I've decided that that's not canon.
Exactly. But then, of course, they end up going up to Unit Tower, and we meet Mel. Mel's returned.
Yeah,
and she actually goes near a computer for the first time in the show ever.
Yeah, and she doesn't really do anything.
I know it's an anniversary special, but I don't know why she was there.
I love bringing back old characters, but, and again, this is one of the reasons that this episode bugged me. I love bringing back old characters. I think it's great, but this felt like it was just there for fan service, considering she didn't do anything. It's the same as Kate Stewart in The Vanquishers. I mean, to be fair, she had more agency than Kate Stewart in The Vanquishers, but not by much. She was just brought back for the sake of being brought back, it felt like. But it was nice to have a little tied up story of why she was on Earth and Power. And it continued nicely from Power, of her being recruited by unit when in power we saw her and Kate in the companion support group and Kate going, I might want to recruit some people for unit. So that followed on nicely, but I don't know. I don't like bringing people back if they just do nothing for the episode. And I don't think she did anything for the episode besides going la 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 la.
She pulled David Tennant.
Anyone could have done that. Kate maybe... could have done that. Kate could have had more of a role if she'd got to pull David Tennant.
Maybe David Tennant was like, no, she must pull me. It was on his list of demands.
Uh-huh. It was nice to see her though, because I mean, I thought she was coming back for series 14 or season one, I guess. But I was wrong. Apparently, everyone knew she'd be in this apart from me. I must have misremembered the promo.
I didn't expect Mel to turn up.
I don't know if it was ever officially announced, but people saw a ginger person in the trailers and were like, oh, it's Mel.
And they were right, to be fair.
Yeah. This might be sort of set up for why she's back in the future, possibly.
Yeah, depending on how she's used in the future, my opinions might change a bit.
Like, if they're building up to the unit spin-off they said they were going to do or was rumoured to do, it might be that she has more of a main part in that.
That would make sense. That would make me feel like it was more, like, justified. But even so, I wish she'd had more agency in this episode. But, hey. So we have the concept of the giggle. The toy maker's laugh is that little... arpeggio. I'm probably butchering it, but I love that concept. I think that's such a good concept.
I love as well the fact that they actually use something from history, like a small part about Stooky Bill on the TV. And of course, what we watched afterwards, RTT actually saw that and thought, hey, why don't we use it for Doctor Who? And it just works perfectly. I love when they do that.
Yeah, it's so clever. It's a little nugget of history. Because these specials are almost like a mini-series in of themselves. We had an opener, a sort of filler episode, and a finale. And it's and we've had sort of sci-fi, we've had Earth, and we got a little bit of history in this one. And that laugh, that little arpeggio is a laugh, sounds so creepy. I love that when Mel does it, it puts the people like Donna and everyone slightly on edge. Like, you can see the effect it has on them. And I love that it's built into the soundtrack, the actual, like, incidental music, or whatever the term is. I love when you have that, when you've got the link between something actually in the show and the music that only we can hear and the characters can't. Like, John Sims Masters theme largely uses the rhythm of four, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, or the Doctor's theme being brought into the Ood song in The End of Time. And in this, you have that little arpeggio, the toy maker's laugh, as the toy maker's actual musical cue, his theme, which I think is such a... I love that. I love... Murray Gold is a genius. I do wonder if RTD was like, can you do this, please? Or like how much the musical stuff was... I don't know, how if he had a chat with Murray Gold about what musical cue would be best to for the toy maker's laugh to sound like. Yeah, obviously then we have, they go to the past, they find the toy maker's toy shop, and we probably see him for the first time. Neil Patrick Harris is the toy maker. Amazing.
Yeah,
he's incredible.
The accent, I know why they were doing the accent. It just it was meant to be so ridiculous, and I get that. But it was almost too ridiculous for me. That makes sense. Like, it was almost... like, it was meant to be... I think it was Unleashed that was talking about how the first toy maker was based in racism. And they wanted to do a little, like... I don't think homage is the right word, but a little...
Homage is definitely not the right word.
A little nod to that with the different accents.
An acknowledgement, not just pretending like this wasn't a problem.
Yeah, with lots of different accents. So I get that it's meant to be almost like a caricature of the accent, but it was really stupid. And I think For some people, it was the right side of stupid. For me, it sort of launched a little bit over it, that it took me slightly out of the episode. I found it a little bit annoying.
That's fair. I think, for me, that's one of the things that... For me, it wasn't on that side. I think, for me, the toy maker was just very over the top and flamboyant and silly. And so, and in a sense, in the way RTD described it in Doctor Who Unleashed, spoilers for Doctor Who Unleashed, it's sort of, he was using it as a form of attack to be evil. So in my mind, I see it in the same bracket as Kate being ableist in her ridiculous bigoted tirade. It's almost showing that it's bad by showing someone who's bad, or in Kate's case, someone who has had their mind turned bad. And then, yeah, in the Toymaker's case, he is a villain using that to be evil. So, yeah, I don't know. I think it works. But I fully understand why it doesn't and why you would find it annoying. But yeah, I think the characterisation and the acting of the Toymaker is brilliant. Neil Patrick Harris is a wonderful actor. And then, of course, we get a little bit inside the Toymaker's realm, which I thought was terrifying, like, in a really good way.
And
it's like a more spooky episode of Scooby-Doo, that bit.
They're running through the doors, yeah. The puppets were great.
Yeah, oh, the puppets. They were cool. Both the marionettes and the...
Great.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. They were horrifying. They were horrifying.
Yeah. Mm. I love that they actually did them with real puppets as well.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, the doctor's...
The war erasure, though, with the puppets.
Oh, yeah. So we get to the actual puppet show.
Those puppets.
I think, yeah. So did you mean when the doctor and Donna were, like, going through the house and seeing them in the rooms? And, like...
Yeah, I meant like
kicking the Stooky Babbies.
Oh, you mean the actual large puppet?
And the full human size puppet.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah, that was awful.
Mm.
Do you think that was intentional, though?
Yeah.
Oh, I meant awful as in scary, not awful as in bad.
Mm.
Like, it's going to be hard to, like, animate a man's head on a doll body without it looking slightly weird.
For that one, there's a clip of it on YouTube, I think. They had the actor in a blue suit doing the scene, and then they had the puppeteers do the body over the top of that and merged them together.
Yeah. I think they did the best they could have done. And it's similar with Wild Blue Yonder. I heard someone say they got a much bigger budget, and instead of doing the same things and making them look amazing, they could just do even more crazy things. Which I love. Yeah. I love that. To be fair, Star Beast was sort of normal kind of Doctor Who level, and it looked amazing. And then Wild Blue Yonder and The Giggle, they just went for more crazy things, which I'm fully on board with. And to be honest, it didn't even look bad. It looked at moments a tiny bit janky, but I thought it was perfectly good. And it slightly made it more creepy. Like, the Uncanny Valley kind of works in this situation because it's supposed to be really uncanny. Yeah. But then, yes, as you were referencing, Bertie, we then get to the scene where the toy maker is sort of recapping the Moffat and Chibnall era for Donna. I think that was brilliant. I'm here for the Chibnall companion erasure. In all seriousness.
That's all right then.
In all seriousness, I do think people sort of joke about it as like, oh, just ignore Chibnall's companions. I think it works. I think that's, I don't think that's a problem at all for two reasons. Firstly, it would have just taken forever to go through every single companion. Secondly, because they didn't have sad endings, and that whole scene was about making the Doctor feel awful about himself and showing all the people he failed to save and all the people who died in his mind because of him. And that applies sort of to all the Moffatera companions and to none of the Chibnall ones. But yeah,
I mean, the Moffat companions didn't die. I mean, like, Rory and Amy end up dead, but that's not from, like, spooky. That's
well, that's
age.
All right, then.
Because none of the Chimnel companions have a thing that would work with the that's all right then structure of that.
I think the whole Flux thing is all about this is the most momentous thing that happened to the Doctor in that time frame. I think that's the way the Toymaker's going about it.
That, or, and also it was recent. Yeah. And I think also, like, in terms of the Doctor's guilt for Amy and Rory, okay, yes, they did live a full life, but they didn't, they were taken away from their own life. They had to, you know, they would have never seen any other than each other. They never see anyone they knew again. They lost their home, their family, their jobs, their lives. They were still, it was still a very tragic thing. It just wasn't a death. But yeah, I agree with, I don't remember who said it, but I'm not here for the Rory erasure.
You know, Amy did not go through that alone. There was another guy there. And he went through stuff as well. But I guess, how would you act that out with a little creepy doll?
I don't know. Well, to be fair, like, the things weren't really acted out. You just had the dolls there, being sort of puppeted by the toy maker. You could have just had a Rory doll at the same time. I don't know. I'm also sad about the Nardole erasure, but that's more justified, because with Amy and Rory, you could say Amy and Rory, not just Amy. Whereas with Nardole, you'd have to do a whole separate thing, where it's like, and Nardole was trapped on Z's cybership. Yes, but I don't actually know what happened to him in the end. Well, that's all right then. And it would have been a bit awkward.
There wasn't... Rory got mentioned. He's the one who waits.
Yes, the one who waits. I've said this with the Meeps boss. I've said this with the Line of Salt, which got paid off sooner than I thought. Well done, Harry, for being right when the rest of us were wrong. And we got this with the one who waits. RTD very obviously setting up plot lines. Like, the least
My
subtle...
legions are coming.
Yes, that. And also the person hand. With the red nail polish picking up the gold tooth with the like, you couldn't have less subtle setting up of storylines.
I watched it again. Kate did have red nail polish.
Yeah, she definitely did. It's been been all over, like, my like side of social media. It's just pictures of Kate, like, with her hand circled going, it's Kate, she's gonna bring back the Master. Like, well, probably not on purpose.
But last time this happened, the nail polish was done to make people think that it was Lucy Saxon when it wasn't. So it could be another sort of misdirect.
Lucy also, Saxon's back.
The way that hand was, like, positioned, the person whose hand it was floating off the edge of the platform.
I think it's not to be taken too seriously, that's... why?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's just hinting the Master's coming back.
Yeah. I do think the plot line setting up is... It's not awful, but it could have been a little bit more subtle. A little bit.
It feels like when you're writing an essay, which now I'm realising this is not the group to be like, when you're writing an essay to.
To the two maths and the physics students.
Yeah. So sometimes when you write essays, you have to be, like, really glaringly obvious that you're answering the question by just tagging it on the end somewhere. And that's how this feels like. It feels like when you're writing an essay, you have no idea what you're actually saying. You just repeat the question back and hope for the best.
Has Russell got a social sciences degree between his two eras of Doctor Who?
Man decided to go to study sociology for a bit.
Yeah, a lot of his sort of stories across series previously have been sort of very subtle, like things happening in the background.
I think,
or
also,
mentions are like one word.
I mean, when I think about it, because we all go, Moffat does stories and RTD does character. Classic Who had no story, so the storylines he had were the biggest storylines we'd ever had. And then Moffat came in with, I know, the key to time, Trial of a Time Lord. There are a couple of exceptions, but apart from like a couple. By and large, Classic Who didn't have storylines. And then RTD probably had much more prominent than most people. And then Moffat came in with big, proper storylines. And I feel like RTD's realised the extent to which Doctor Who can do more complicated storylines or more involved storylines. And I feel like he's trying to do that. And maybe he'll do a great job of it. I'm excited to see what happens. But it was so not subtle. But anyway, we can move on from that, unless anyone else has something else to say about that. The whole scene with the second game, the splitting of the cards, I think it was an interesting scene. It was perfect. It was good. I feel like in some ways it's a clever thing for the Doctor to do, where the toy maker theoretically is really good at like all games. So almost maybe your best chance is a 50-50 shot by cutting a deck of cards.
Donna's face when they have to run again, there was no shock. There was nothing. She's just like, I know the drill now.
That was hilarious. Running. That was so funny. And one thing that bothered me a bit, and this is a recurring theme, things that bothered me a bit, but don't, there's nothing that I dislike that ruins the episode, but there's lots of things that bother me a bit. I think general, this opening sequence, not sequence, like the opening 10 minutes, I was talking to Joseph about this, are very, very heavy on exposition in a way that if Chibnall did it, people would be tearing it apart, but everyone forgives RTD. But it is. It's just so much exposition in a not the most engaging way.
There were a lot of places and dates coming up on the screen that people always criticise Chibnall for.
Personally, I don't mind that, whether it's Chibnall or RTD, but it is quite funny. It is quite funny. But yeah, one thing that bothered me is the Doctor goes, you don't get a prize toy maker because this is one all. I won a game back in the 60s, and now you won a game now. So best of three. But like, the Doctor got his quote-unquote prize for winning the first game and destroying the Toymaker's realm and escaping. So surely the Toymaker should have got a prize for winning this game.
He danced when he got back to
the
unit.
He did it.
That was his prize, was getting to dance to the Spice Girls. Shall we talk about that? That scene, dancing to the Spice Girls.
It was everything to me and more. It was done for the girls' gays and theys, and if anyone dislikes it...
I loved that so much. It was amazing. It was perfect. It was so stupid, and I loved it.
The doors just keep coming up, and it shot perfectly. That it just doesn't contradict. I mean, it's the toy maker. He can do whatever he wants.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely hilarious.
The fact that in the middle of all of this, there are two very horrific deaths as well.
Yeah, I think it does something, I'd say, similarly to the Rasputin thing seen in Power of the Doctor, in a positive way, because I love that scene as well. It's really stupid and cheesy and camp, but also hilarious and amazing, and I love it. But also a bit sinister, because in Power, the Master is dancing over, literally about to erase the Doctor's identity, surrounded by two of the most terrifying races in the universe. In this, the Toymaker is being terrifying and literally killing people, like turning people into balls, and then they're not just dead, they're screaming inside the balls. It's a bit horrifying, and I think that's brilliantly done. I love it.
There's something so... I think fun's not quite the word for it, but there's something really fun about villains having little dancey moments to the most cheesiest pop music. Because you've got some really good bangers in Doctor Who, mainly from The Master, because you've got Voodoo Child.
Yeah, and Rescue. I Can't Decide.
Yeah.
Yeah, Johnson dances to both of those. And then with Cassandra, you get... she doesn't dance to it because she's a little flappy thing, and also to be fair, she's not really gloating villainously, but she's a villain, and she puts on Toxic and I think Tainted Love.
There's like some really good tunes, but I think it also shows who RTD is for his song choices as a person, that he chose Spice Girls.
Well, everyone knows it in Unleashed. And then it just cuts to Neil Patrick Harris saying, I've never heard that song before in my life.
Yeah. Ollie, you had never heard it before, had you?
I think I've heard the song, but I'm not, like, at all familiar with it. Like, Neil Patrick Harris was saying, like, every British person knows all the words. Not even close. I'm sure I've heard the song, but, like, I'm not familiar with it at all.
That's crazy to me. That's on, like, every, like, every Pride playlist has Spice Up Your Life. Every year, you go down to Durham Pride, Spice Girls is playing, and you're like, please, please, can we have a newer song?
I think by benefit of nothing to do with the actual song, just by benefit of the toy maker having danced to it, is now one of my favourite songs of all time. Nothing to do with the quality of the song itself.
The song's quality, though. Don't be slagging off the Spice Girls.
Oh, no, I'm not slagging off the Spice Girls. It's like, it's great, but the fact that I love it has nothing to do with the fact that it's great.
Third wave feminism is characterised by the Spice Girls in A-level sociology. When you get taught about it, you get the Spice Girls played for you.
Ah, I like it.
So is the toy maker a feminist icon? Discuss.
Perhaps he is. I do love it.
He does slam Kate into a wall. So.
Yeah.
I don't... And Mel. He doesn't yeet Mel into a wall, but he tries to.
He yeets her onto the floor.
Yeah.
It's I remember I was talking to Rebecca about it, and she was saying, like, she recognises all the problems I have with the episode and everything that I say is flawed, but to her, it's a perfect episode just because of that scene. And honestly, I love that. That is the correct opinion. The correct opinion.
I mean, firstly, you could never argue with Rebecca. Secondly, she's right for it. There's a lot of nibbly things in the episode that I'm like, if you wanted a 5K essay, you can have one. But that scene makes up for a lot of them.
Yeah. I think this episode, generally, a lot of my problems, not all of them, but a lot of my biggest problems would be fixed by it being two parts. I think there are so many Doctor Who finales that
I agree.
By being one part and have to go too fast. Time of the Doctor, that's the main one, to be honest, Time of the Doctor. But, like, there are a few.
What do we all think about Bi-Generation?
So, in principle, I think it's a good idea. I don't think there's anything wrong with the idea. I think it's a great idea. I think the special effects were great. I have a couple of issues with it. The first issue is that it's just not really explained how it happened. It just sort of did. Like, if there was justification for it, like, if they explained it was to do with the toy maker, like, it's maybe sort of implied it's because they're in a state of play or whatever, but it's not really explained. And the toy maker has no idea what's going on. So,
explanation for the TARDIS, right? So it's probably the same.
If it was properly explained why it happened in a satisfactory way, I think it would bother me a lot less. But because I don't think in principle I have a problem with it, but it's just happens. Like, it's an ancient myth of the Time Lord. It just happens in this case. Yeah. I don't know. What do you guys think about it?
My sort of issue with it is what actually happens to 14 now? Like, can he regenerate? Will he, like, go magically back in time to that moment when he dies and becomes 15?
Is like that a little how it works?
Yeah,
I think it needs addressing.
Or is he like the curator now?
Will he regenerate into the curator, and it's that branch of the double? Like... Yeah.
I agree with that. I love the idea of a doctor meeting the future self, either knowingly or unknowingly.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what happens, because surely the question is, there's just a doctor hanging around in France, sees the trouble in the earth at the moment, and just goes, oh, cool, sips coffee, heads back in. If you're going to set up a unit family with another doctor, surely you're just doing Doctor Who, but the spin-off.
I don't think... the 14th Doctor will return. I think the idea is that he's retired, he's just going to live in France. I think, to be honest, in principle, it's a great ending. I'm slightly cheesed off that we that David Tennant's I Don't Want to Go at the End of the End of Time is not so sad anymore. I feel like it takes away from that a bit, but it is a very beautiful ending. It is such a lovely ending, and it's so nice, to be fair, after all these years, that he gets to have his retirement. He gets to live with his family, with Donna's family. It's a very nice idea in principle. I just have a couple of feelings about aspects of it.
I really loved it, and there's many, many, many reasons I really, really, really loved it. I think my first thing is I am probably the least biggest fan of Doctor Who out of all of us. Still a huge fan. You put me in Average Society, they're like, God help you. But in Whosock, I'm practically casual. So things that don't make sense to me in Doctor Who happens quite often. I just brush past it. It's normal for me. Half the time I was like, who's Mel? Where do I know Mel from? Ah, she was in that one Jodie Whittaker episode. That's how I know this lady. But I wasn't like too hung up, but it's perfectly valid to be hung up on that. I was then super, super happy because usually your first moments with a new doctor are steeped in grief because you have just lost, you know, a character that you loved so very much. I remember when Matt Smith regenerated, because I was watching Doctor Who then, and I was bawling my little eyes out. I was like, don't take Matt Smith away from me. I don't want Peter Capaldi. I mean, in the end, he turns out to be my favourite doctor. But I like the fact that I wasn't sad. I like the fact that I could meet Shuti and be like, oh, actually, yeah, I don't have to be sad, irrationally sad and angry that you've taken the space of someone who, a character that I really loved. I then was super, super happy about the Doctor finding his family in a platonic sense as an aromantic person. I don't know if 14 is aromantic. I know that he fancies guys, and as he should. It was just something really beautiful to me that his happy ending wasn't a romantic relationship. It wasn't him going around finding the romantic love of his life. He settled down in an unconventional family structure, which is something that we should be normalizing, and normalizing on television is big. Do I think RTD was doing it for Arrow people out there? Probably not. But it was really nice to see an unconventional family structure, well, unconventional to us. Have just you, your platonic best mate, platonic soulmate, best mate, in a little French countryside with your niece and your brother-in-law now, with Wilf, who isn't shooting moles. And finally, I'm really happy that, you know, Shuti's doctor is no longer, you know, he's traumatized. He's gone through trauma, but he has now, through some time stuff, when I didn't swear, it's fine, can now move along. And every episode of Doctor Who will not be David Tennant v his many, many demons. It's not Peter Capaldi versus everything that keeps Peter Capaldi's doctor up at night. It's a good place to start afresh, which is what they wanted his series to be, a good jumping point for new fans. So it's not going to be Shuti Gatwa versus many, many demons, just Shuti Gatwa versus a couple demons, because I'm sure, you know, therapy can't fix everything.
He'll get some new demons.
Yeah, there'll be some new demons. He'll be traumatized some other way. But it's nice that he's no longer dragging around baggage, which I think suits his doctor, is good for new fans, and I get my cute little platonic soulmates in the French countryside.
Yeah, that's fair. I think it is really, really nice that we get to see 15 now unburdened by it. Again, I don't feel like it's entirely justified. Like, I feel like that should be done via like character development, which RTD is really good at, which it felt like it wasn't. It felt like he just, ooh, rehab out of order, I'm fine now. Which is like, you know, the 14th Doctor got to settle down and have his wonderful life and sort of get the life he never had. But there's still a version of the Doctor who doesn't get that. I don't know. It didn't quite feel right to me, because is Shoot to Get was just a continuation of David Tennant, or has he been through the rehab? Because I don't know. It didn't feel just. I think what happened in the end was beautiful and lovely. I just think how we got there wasn't convincing.
Big Finish will pick it up. We, in 10 years' time, are going to have David Tennant's 14th Doctor going through therapy in a Big Finish series. It's just going to be David Tennant and, like, a therapist played by probably Ty Tennant. There's not many that actors that Doctor Who will get these days. Mm. So it's just going to be David Tennant and Ty Tennant going through therapy as the Doctor. And no one will listen to it.
Also,
they'll fix it.
Can we talk about the game of ball? Game of ball to save the world. I have some issues with this. In principle, I love the idea that we've got the massive Disney budget. It's a Disney Plus show, and rather than a big epic final battle, it's a game of ball. But I do have issues with it. I think, first of all, it's not the Doctor using his mind or his persuasion or his cleverness. It's not the companion. It's not anything to do with Mel or Donna or Rose or Kate. It's just like a physical thing. And I feel like, first of all, the toy maker should be like incredibly good at these things to justify that he's the toy maker and wins like against everyone except the one who waits. And I don't think he should lose a game of ball like that. But also, it's the toy maker's bound by rules. It's all about the rules. The only rules he follows are the rules of the game. What are the rules of this game? Because firstly, I'm like, why can't the toy maker just throw it backwards off unit tower and automatically win? And someone will go, oh, but it's then technically his fault that the Doctor dropped it. So therefore he loses. But then you can go, okay, but surely then if he whacks it really hard at the Doctor when he drops it, that's then his fault. So why is he doing that? But then you can go, and then people will go, oh, well, technically you touched it, so it's your fault as soon as you touched it. But then you can go, can't the Doctor just jump out of the way of the ball and it be the Toymaker's fault? Like, I don't know. It's there's no like consistent rules, and it's really hard for me to get invested in something when you don't know what the stakes are and you don't know what the characters are and aren't allowed to do. And I feel like it's a really, really weak and anticlimactic ending to a villain who has built up so, so much. The Doctor being written and acted to be incredibly terrified. We had so much publicity for the Toymaker. It's a villain we've not seen for like over 55 years, almost 60 years. And all that. And they just won a game of ball.
If you look at a game of catch. Just a little bit. What other show is going to have the world saved by some people playing catch?
Again, in principle, it's not a bad idea. And they could have made that work, I think, but they just didn't.
Even in the original Toymaker story, there was essentially the Doctor won by using the voice command of the TARDIS to move a piece somewhere else. It's really not the most inventive thing. It's something that I was going to say that the Toymaker is an incredibly powerful person, but if you play a game with some slight advantage to yourself, then you'll be fine. How devastating is the Toymaker, really, then?
Yeah, it just makes him seem like a not very scary villain if you can defeat him by going, I challenge you to a game! And just winning the game, just like that.
But I guess when the Toymaker is, you know, going up against a human, how many humans would be like, I challenge you to a game? And how many of us would be like, ah, this is an immortal being with the powers of God who can turn me into a ball. Ah, you know?
Yeah, but like, that's like that. So like the only reason he's dangerous is because they don't know how, like.
He's
just scary because he's scary.
Yeah, but then if you lose the game, he can do whatever he wants, right? So it's it's not a get out of jail free card.
Yeah, but it's clearly not that hard to win a game against him. Like, just get some Olympic athlete who's really good at like gymnastics, and just beat the toy maker.
The new Doctor Who spin-off: Tom Daly versus the Toy Maker.
I'm sorry, it didn't sit right with me.
I think there was like an implication, though I get why you're annoyed. In my head, the way I've justified it is that there was an implication that they probably discussed the rules beforehand, but RTD was like, maybe it would be too boring to sit there and watch the toy maker and two doctors hash out the rules of Catch, because it would be boring.
Section but one, like, subsection two.
But what
if this happened?
I mean, I'd like to call my lawyer now.
But like, they made fleshing out the rules of cutting a pack of cards entertaining. Like the directing and the acting and the writing with cut the back, highest card wins, ace is high. Like that, somehow they made that entertaining.
Yeah, but there's more rules than Catch. Yeah.
There's a lot less rules for cutting a deck and seeing who has the bigger card.
Yeah, but like, I think for me, I need to know what the rules are to be invested.
I feel like if I knew what the rules were, I would be focusing too much on the actual, like, throwing to see if they were technically correct.
I mean, the actual, like, content of the game of Catch, cutting back and forth between people catching a ball, right?
Mm.
There's not a lot that you could really infer from that, even if you didn't know what all the rules were.
Yeah.
They have caught the ball every time, so it's fine.
I mean, wasn't there a part where the doctor sort of did a bow roll? That was actually filmed with a green screen on the actual floor. So technically, that wasn't really real in the world of real life.
There was very little
catching
going on. They had the balls already in their hands and were just hiding them until they'd caught them.
Mm. I mean, like, that was quite funny because I saw it was either in Unleashed or in something they put on YouTube. She was saying, I just couldn't catch the ball, so I had to do it like that. But hopefully, you couldn't tell. You could tell. Or at least for me, you can tell.
If you watch
tell.
It knowing that, you can tell, definitely.
No, I on first watch, I could tell.
Okay.
Like, that's... like, surely, Shooty, you can... Okay, I don't want to diss Shooty. Can we talk about Shooty? He's amazing. I love Shooty Gatwa's Doctor so much.
First thing he did in that TARDIS was put on some mood lighting. That's how I know I can trust this man.
I love
he really, off the big light.
I really like the idea of the jukebox there. It just gives it a bit more life than compared with the 14 TARDIS.
I think in the Starbeast podcast, I said I didn't like the TARDIS that much, but it's really growing on me. The more I see of it, the more I really, really like it. But I stand by what I say about it needing to feel more homely. But putting the jukebox in there and Shooty commented on needing more sofas, I feel like they're going to get something. So I'm feeling happy about that.
Depending on exactly how the bigeneration splitting the TARDIS in half has worked, technically 14 might put the jukebox in and then it shows up again when 15 gets the TARDIS.
I mean, but 14 was surprised to see a jukebox in 15 TARDIS.
Yeah, but like later on, he gets the jukebox. And then...
Oh, I see.
Brings 14's TARDIS back there.
Yeah, it could be.
It's not explained. Like, are there just two TARDISes, or is it the same TARDIS at two different points in time?
See, that bothered me in a similar way of the bigeneration, which... It's explained a little bit more, but like that's, you forget the TARDIS is alive. That's a whole life form you've just duplicated.
The Doctor's alive.
Yeah, but like it's different incarnations. And like, you know, that's at least addressed that you've got two different Doctors now going on their own paths. Whereas the TARDIS, they seem to, in that scene, to forget that it's a life form you've just doubled. I don't know. But I do, yeah. I want to focus briefly on talking about Shooty Gatwa's Doctor and how amazing he was. He feels a lot like Matt Smith's, but like gayer.
Can we talk about the thing we were shown for next time?
Yes. The only thing we've been shown that we're not spoiling is the song, apart from just saying it was amazing.
I haven't listened to the song.
Oh, it's a banger.
I know a lot of people aren't, and that's so valid, but it's amazing.
I love the fact that he's in a kilt. It looks like a kilt in the club.
I think it is a kilt, yeah.
I thought it was just a skirt, but I didn't look very hard.
I've seen online people calling it a kilt.
Yeah,
I've got really awful eyesight, so I can't tell because it looks quite dark in there. So it could be a kilt. I think it would be brilliant if it was a kilt. Or it could be a skirt and people are just like, a man wearing a skirt? It's a kilt.
It probably, I don't know.
I like that he's changing his outfit more. One of the my bugbears about the Doctor is that he dresses like a cartoon character in the fact that he doesn't change his what he wears.
12 did quite a bit.
Like
12 had a lot of variations of the same thing.
As did 4, I'd say.
Maybe that's why 12 is my favourite Doctor. Maybe it's not the character development, it's not Peter Capaldi, it's simply because he changed his outfit a little bit more.
Four's just sort of changed over time. I think 12's sort of goes back and forth like weekly.
Mm-hmm. I like the idea of 14's outfit changing. I hope the essence of what it roughly looks like remains consistent though. So we have a consistent
statement
sort of outfit. Yeah.
A couple of statement pieces and like a colour scheme he sticks to.
In this episode, his outfit is just no trousers. It's just Tennant's outfit with the undone tie and no trousers. Which is hilarious to me. I love it.
Every time he came on screen, someone was just saying, put some trousers on.
I love him, though. I think he feels quite different. I mean, he's very camp, which is brilliant. He feels very different to any Doctor we've had, and it jarred me slightly at first, but I've rewatched scenes on YouTube, and I've seen the Next Time trailers, and every time I see anything from him, I love it more. I'm at the point where I'm just boiling with excitement to see more of this Doctor. I just love him so much. And I love his theme. We get his theme televised for the first time, and it's so good. Yeah, it's got so much energy. It's so... Murray Gold, you're a genius. I love you.
He feels younger.
Yeah, and he feels...
He feels unburdened.
Yeah. And he's so fun and silly and flamboyant. My first Doctor was Matt Smith, and he had that fun, silly, flamboyant energy. And the Doctor doesn't have to be that. But we've not had a Doctor... I think Jodie was supposed to be like that, but she wasn't. We've not had a Doctor quite like that since Matt Smith, and I'm so glad that we do. And I like... We've not even really had... I suppose some classic Doctors were like that in their own way, but I'm so glad we got that again, and I'm so excited to see more of him. And he just looks like it's going to be an absolute laugh. But yeah. Yeah. Shooter Get were knocked out of the park. No notes. Top 10. Not top 10? 10 out of 10, I think is what I meant there.
In my top 10 of Doctors. Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
that's more than half of the Doctors. if I made a top 10 list of Doctors, that is more than half of them. I would be very surprised if he didn't make it onto a top 10 list of Doctors. He looks like he's going to be one of my favourites, but it's sort of too soon to tell. But he just looks...
I love that the Doctor was in a club. I mean, he's no longer relatable, because I simply just wouldn't turn up to a club.
Oh yeah, as someone who doesn't like clubbing, I'm like, I can't relate to this Doctor.
But him going
clubbing... The fact he's nailing has nothing to do with it.
Look, like, young 10-year-old me saw Matt Smith's Doctor and made it my whole personality.
Your writing style is a little bit like how Matt Smith speaks as the 11th.
Yeah, Doctor. In writing Conversations from the Coffee Shop, my comedy, I've realised, rewatching Christmas Carol in Who's Sock, it's a bit Matt Smith-esque. Yeah. But yeah, I'm so... I don't think he'll be just like Matt Smith again. Like I said, he's much more camp. And it's beautiful. It's so beautiful. Do we have anything...
I'm excited for Ruby.
Oh yeah, Ruby looks like she's going to be great. Yeah, we've not seen very much of her, but she does look like she's going to be great.
Mm-hmm. And they meet at... Club, which
yeah,
is fun.
It looks
that's
like
what the trailer says. Yeah,
the trailer seems to imply that.
That basically happens with the first Doctor and Ben and Polly. I'd argue they all met up in a club.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The first Doctor wore a skirt. Was like, I'm going to order a cosmopolitan, and I'm going to head to Jimmy's. That's what he did. I was there.
By the way, just to bounce around the timeline a little bit here, I love that. I find it quite funny that two Doctors consecutively were killed by a giant laser. It was
Capaldi got hit by a few lasers as well, but I don't know if that was actually what killed him or not.
Yeah.
Well, and what did kill off 13?
A massive laser.
The big thing quarks. That was powering the cyber planet that they'd stolen from the train.
It lasered her.
The master pressed a little button on his remote and it lasered her.
Oh.
It was much more undignified, but I do find it hilarious that two consecutive doctors were killed by massive lasers.
And the lasers gunnery crew. Where have they gone? I think they're still falling. Crash.
Yeah. I like a lot of things in this episode. It was comical, but also quite sinister.
Mm.
Yeah, I think that was great. Yeah. Overall, I liked the episode, but I have a lot of nitpicks. Like, not one or nothing that ruins the episode, but a lot of small nitpicks. unless anyone has any final closing thoughts, I shall move on to podcast questions. We've got quite a lot of them this week. Lottie wants to know, do we think the One Who Waits or the Toymaker's Legions are going to be the main antagonists of Series 14? They'll definitely come up and they'll definitely be villains. I don't know if they'll be of Series 14 or later down the line.
Yeah. I would.
Because how far ahead can you plan that?
Like, is the boss the same person as the Legions?
To me, it seems like the boss is the One Who Waits and the Legions might be something else. I expect, if I had to guess, they'd be likely be coming in like Series 15-ish. But I'm just going on vibes. I don't know. They'll definitely be big villains. And Cormac wants to know, and Harry addressed this already, but alternatively, do we think the One Who Waits is in fact Rory Williams? Yes.
Yes.
Rory, come back.
After Darville getting wheeled out again.
Jacob wants to know, it's not a question, but drop your most controversial Doctor Who take and insist you are right.
We were already doing that for Who's viewers. Sorry, Jacob.
Louis saying Sarah Jane's not actually that good a companion.
I said that a while ago. I'm surprised you remember.
You, Market Square.
I don't know. I don't think I have any super controversial Doctor Who opinions.
No. Mine are quite basic. Martha's one of the best companions. Nine is not loved enough.
Martha is now the only one of Ten's companions not to have a David Tennant living with her.
Which is fair, because she's the only one who actually chose to leave David Tennant.
Yeah.
Martha Jones is foaming at the mouth.
But also, I realise, you saying that's made me realise, maybe one of my controversial Doctor Who views is I'm not as big a fan of Christopher Eccleston's Doctor.
Well, you'd be wrong.
No, but you see, I'm right. Because I've always been right. Yeah, he's grown on me. He, like, Time War trauma, yeah, he acts well against the Daleks, but he doesn't feel like that good a Doctor. He just doesn't feel Doctor-y to me. He doesn't feel like the Doctor. He just doesn't.
But he was resonating concrete.
He was trying to resonate concrete. We got David Tennant actually succeeding this time.
That was Mortar.
Oh, yes, it was Mortar. I'm sorry.
Captain Jack Harkness, in Doctor Who, if you ignore Torchwood, is a bit flat as a character. Don't know if that's controversial. Torchwood does a lot to flesh him out, but in actual Doctor Who, he's sort of just a guy who likes to have sex. And I'm like, okay, sure.
I disagree.
An immortal guy that likes to have sex.
You've got to be there. I forgot he's immortal.
Such character.
I disagree, but to be fair, he's not, outside of Torchwood, he's not the most developed character, but because he's developed in Torchwood, but he always feels real and authentic, and he has his little journey to me. Like, because at the start of, especially in late series one, at the start of The Empty Child, he's just trying to scam people, he's just trying to do things for his own profit, and then he ends up caring for people and always trying to do the right thing.
That's sort of a character arc you see a lot in Doctor Who. Like, someone's life is touched by a by the Doctor and they become a much better person. So that's what I was expecting. But, like, outside his actual, like, character development there, he doesn't feel like a character, whereas Torchwood makes him into a character. And that's probably just because he doesn't have a lot of screen time within actual main Doctor Who. So they've not got enough time to make him a character. But,
that's
like...
That's fair.
Yeah.
Harry, do you have any really controversial Doctor Who takes?
I don't think so.
Who's the worst companion?
Okay, I guess.
From New Who?
Brian. That's not controversial, though.
Yeah, I wasn't even thinking about the Chibnall ones.
Yeah,
they are that famous.
Yeah, I think it probably is Ryan.
Yeah. Ignoring the Chibnall.
Rose?
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you.
A lot of flack. She's a 19-year-old girl. Leave her alone.
Yeah, but she's annoying. All the ones are just better.
And why did she have to have a romantic arc with the Doctor? He's literally a 900-year-old alien.
Yeah, that was not the move. It was typical of the time. But
yeah. Anyway, just... Joe wants to know, who is the Vlinx? Yeah, that's not addressed.
I think it will be addressed
equivalent
in...
of Mr. Smith.
Ooh. Maybe. I mean, I imagine it will be addressed later on in hypothetical unit series, or if we return to units, we go, the Vlinx is this. And
I hope so.
We did say that about the Meta Crisis, though. So, turns out they just let it go. That was it.
It was in one of the Torchwood novels. They talk about the Torchwood mainframe being alive, like the computer is like part organic. Sort of like Mr. Smith, but not quite. So I was sort of feeling like either they've scavenged around the old Torchwood 3 base for a bit, because that did get blown up, didn't it?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Not seen Torchwood.
I think in Children of Earth. Pretty sure it gets blown up. So I was like, maybe they've scavenged around Torchwood for a bit. Maybe they went to Sarah Jane's house. Seems like something.
Blinks is Mr. Smith.
Yeah.
Combined with the Torchwood mainframe.
Yeah.
Mr. Smith is the war Blinks.
I've realised, Harry, you did just mention something that bothered me about this episode as well. Well, actually, it bothers me more about the Starbeast, but I thought it would be addressed again, and it just wasn't. The fact that they just let the Meta Crisis go, I thought that would have consequences. I was like, I know how RTD writes, it will have consequences. And it just didn't.
Maybe it's what caused the bi-generation.
But it wasn't.
If it was, we
would have consequences for this, but then consequences need to be like something negative to balance it out. I don't know. To be fair, the same problem, I think. It was just happened and it was too wishy-washy, nice solution. But anyway, maybe that's my controversial Doctor Who take.
I was expecting it to be fixed in the first episode. So then when it was just like, oh, okay.
Peter wants to know, should there have been more characters returning? No, I don't think so. I would have loved to see Matt Smith. I'd have loved to see Peter Capaldi. They wouldn't have fit in this story, and that's fine. We got David Tennant and Judy Gatwa, so it was a multi-Doctor episode, so I'm happy. Like,
I saw a meme someone made where at the scene at the table at the end, David Tennant just sort of sneezes and turns into Matt Smith. And sneezes again and turns into Capaldi.
Yeah. Yeah, that would have been funny. It would have been an interesting thing if the Toy Maker had like cycled through the Doctor's faces and we got like little Matt Smith, Peter Capaldi, Jodie Whittaker, and then Shooter Gatwa, but that wasn't the way the story was going, and that's fine.
I thought would happen in Wild Blue Yonder, where the not things think, oh, this person has other faces, and then start peeling through a bunch of regenerations just for a laugh. But no.
I didn't expect any others to come back, and I'm sort of glad they didn't. It would have felt cheap in this episode, full of things that to me already felt a bit cheap.
Apparently, the reason none of the newer Doctors were in Power of the Doctor was because Chibnall was leaving them for the 60th. For whoever left
it. Well, to be fair, Chibnall didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah.
What, the 70th? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, but like 10 years down the line, you can bring them back in Power and then in the 70th. But anyway, Peter also wants to know, do you think it would have been an attempt at a more traditional style of anniversary special had this miniseries not immediately followed the Power of the Doctor? And do you think RTD might be relieved he could use this excuse? Again, I don't think so. I think this was just the story RTD wanted to tell, and that's perfectly valid. It was, I have nitpicks about the giggle, but overall it was a really good story. I don't
think so. Before he decided he was coming back full time, he had written a different story that was just set during the original series 4, but then when he was taking over fully, he rewrote it into this.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
RTD, release that, please.
Do you guys think, if Power of the Doctor hadn't been what it was, do you think this would have been a more traditional style anniversary?
I think it would, yes. Because the whole thing of having a multi-Doctor anniversary story following on for a generation story this close, there's a way of doing it, and I don't there's a reason why. Take Tom Baker not appearing in The Five Doctors merely about 2 years after he was the Doctor. You could see why, and I really don't think that having a regeneration story and then immediately after a multi-Doctor anniversary story, I don't think it works. But the way that they did the multi-Doctor story here, I think was all right.
Especially when it's a regeneration story that was also sort of a multi-Doctor story and a sort of anniversary episode. I think if that hadn't been a thing, this probably would have been more sort of, it was only really the giggle that felt like an anniversary episode, right?
Yeah, which I'm okay with, but yeah. Martin wants to know, what game would you play against the toy maker? I don't know.
What number am I thinking of?
But make sure you get the first round.
As much as the game of catch doesn't justify this, I feel like the toy maker should be really good at like pretty much all games. So I feel like your best bet would just be to like cut a deck of cards or something and get a 50-50. What games are people particularly good at?
Gartic Phone?
Win a game of Gartic Phone against the toy maker. Winner make it mean.
Yeah, I'd win a make it. I always lose make it mean when we play it, but I think that's because I'm up against Lottie Goldthorpe, who we all know is a god of memes.
Can't argue with that.
We played a couple of rounds of make it mean recently, and you know, I didn't come awfully. So if it's just me against a toy maker, maybe like make it so other people have to vote instead of just us downvoting each other constantly. Like, you know, get a big projector. Because then I'll just make sure everybody upvotes me. So I could even have really boring memes. Just people won't be voting for the toy maker.
Yeah. That's fair. Yeah. Well, I don't know what games I'm good at. I'm not very good at, I feel like the toy maker's speciality are puzzles, but then I'm not very good at like physical games.
You're really good to a point where it makes me want to scream at the game on Discord where your little snake
Landio. I'll play Landio against the toy maker.
Get his Discord account. Start a call. Steal his land.
Iconic. Yeah, I'm beating the toy maker at Landio. Oh dear. Harry, Louis?
I don't know, Mario Kart or something?
Yeah, I'd say Mario Kart Wii as well.
Fair enough. Joe wants to know, which completely random Doctor Who event do you wish was mentioned by 15? I did love that little scene with 15 going through. That felt like a nice little 60th thing, going through all the things that have happened in the 60 years of Doctor Who's history. Time War, Pandorica,
the Pandorica,
Mafic,
the Chen.
That was funny. What do we want mentioned?
Maybe sort of the stuff that people don't really consider canon, just to annoy people. If you do it, the TV
you
movie,
being half human.
Yeah.
That time I got shot in an alleyway.
Time I beefed a police officer.
The children in need specials.
Oh dear. Yeah, that time we gave the Daleks a plunger.
So for a reasonable comfort.
So for a reasonable R. That would have been hilarious if you'd mentioned the sofa of reasonable comfort. Wait, but I thought that was another timeline. How can that work? I'll explain later. Well, that's all right then.
Maybe that's what 14 regenerates into. Regenerates into...
Rowan Atkinson.
Yeah.
For anyone who's not getting this, go watch The Curse of Fatal Death on YouTube.
Please watch The Curse of Fatal Death. It's iconic. Yeah, I don't know what traumatic events happened in Doctor Who that weren't mentioned.
A lot.
The destruction of Skaro. I don't know.
That time Gallifrey got destroyed again.
Yeah, that feels quite significant. Losing Susan. Are you locking her out on the street with no shoes?
The shoe thing really gets to me.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it was a pretty good exhaustive list, plus Baffik Chen, apparently.
Who was the first companion to die?
Katarina. Which was in Dalek Master Plan, aka The Fault of Baffik Chen. So it technically was mentioned.
I mean, was she like an actual companion, or was she like there for an episode and then died because they didn't want to keep her around?
She was a companion. She went in the TARDIS. She travelled to the TARDIS. She assisted. She is a companion.
So she helped. So that's the only stipulation you need to be a companion, is travel in the TARDIS at least once and help the Doctor with something.
Well, she just wanted to reach the place of perfection.
To be fair, in which case Liz doesn't count, because Liz never travelled in the TARDIS.
No. Assisting still counts.
Liz is an assistant, not a companion.
What about, his name's Adam, right? The one with the clicky forehead.
He technically can't. He made things worse. He didn't help with anything.
Mm.
He is counted on like Wikipedia as a Doctor Who companion, I think.
I think so.
I don't count him.
RTD wanted to write a story where it was essentially a failed companion. It's a deliberate thing that Adam screwed up.
Oh, yeah. We have one final podcast question. What game did the Master challenge the Toymaker to? And then in brackets, or any other major character who is mentioned as having been beaten by the Toymaker? The only other character he mentions is having beaten God. So what did he challenge the Master to? What did he challenge God to?
DDR on both accounts.
I think he challenged God to creating a stone he cannot lift. I don't know who listening has heard of that theological paradox. Can God like create something he cannot lift? Questioning the concept of omnipotence, but yeah.
You went straight in with philosophy. I was like, they play Dance Dance Revolution, and you're like, and can God create a stone?
What sort of games does the Master like?
Mind games.
I mean, there's the game Minecraft, where you hop across the room, because it's pie.
Have you seen The Five Doctors, Bertie?
No.
Hopscotch. The Master challenged the Toymaker to a game of hopscotch.
Yes. Yeah. And lost and died.
Yeah, or trapped in a gold tooth. It feels a bit soon to bring back the Master. But to be fair, he wasn't brought back properly, so whatever.
Mm. Anyway. I was kind of surprised when he was mentioned. But...
Mm. Me too. Mm. Yeah, and not even just in passing. It's like, I've got him right here. He's just not coming back. You're right, yeah.
So would this count as a Master story then?
I mean, nah.
No.
Only
he appears.
Only in the sense that, like, the pilot does, because we see the vault that contains Missy. Like, Missy isn't in the episode. It's just, like, we see the prison that she's in. It's the same thing. Yeah. Anyway, that's all the podcast questions. We're going to wrap up this podcast on the giggle. Then I don't know what the next podcast to be released is going to be. Louis, do you have anything to tell us about what next podcast is going to be?
Oh, yeah. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. We've got a few lined up. That'll come out.
We do have a few lined up. I've just got to decide the order.
Yeah.
Because, like, Ghostlight was recorded a little bit ago now.
I think Ghostlight, and so was the Out of the Shadows Confidential and the 37 Confidential.
We've got them.
To be fair, part of the podcast.
To be fair, by the time this releases, they might have come out. I don't know. But to be fair, I'm editing this one. I'll send it off sooner because I'm better than Louis. I'm joking, Louis.
Is any of this getting cut?
I mean, I'll cut out the first little bit where I'm just talking about, is it recording? Is Zoom recording? I don't know. I'm confused.
Yes, but it's not recording.
Bertie hasn't whispered swear words.
It's been really good this episode. I think I should be able to swear, and I might make a change.org petition to let me swear.
Oh, dear. But anyway, that's the Giggle podcast. That's all from me, as well as Louis.
Goodbye.
Harry.
Bye.
And Bertie.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, and we're ending this podcast, but we'll be back soon, so that's all right then.
Purple Radio Podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this Purple Radio podcast. For more great content and to listen live, head to purpleradio.co.uk.